Ipse podcast. We are Ipse, the independent press standards organisation, the independent regulator of the majority of the UK's newspaper and magazine industry. These podcasts are for anyone who's interested in newspapers, journalism, the media, how it's regulated, and of course, Ipse's work. My name is Vicky, I'm your host, and today I'm joined by our joint head of complaints, Lauren Slane, and we are talking about how Ipse can help with potential media intrusion and harassment. So welcome, Lauren, first time on the Ipse podcast. I think when we talk about press harassment, I certainly am imagining kind of big scrums of journalists and paparazzi chasing celebrities down the street. But what do we mean when we're talking about kind of press intrusion?
Yeah, so that's certainly part of it. But the code of practice actually covers journalist conduct through the whole news gathering process. So this can be in the forms of emails, texts, and messages you get in social media from journalists, as well as physical approaches made to you or your home. It can also be just one journalist who's contacting you, or it could be a situation like you have described, where there's real increased kind of media interest or presence around you.
I mean, presumably a lot of the time harassment kind of deals with people that are wanting the actual physical removal of journalists.
Yes, absolutely. So some people find it very intimidating and harassing that journalists come to their home, for example, and doorstep them is kind of the traditional term that you hear used when journalists approach you at home to ask you for your comment and or to try to photograph you perhaps about a story. And the code covers that, this idea that if you're asked to leave property, journalists should do so.
Why are kind of some of the reasons why journalists might kind of do this doorstepping?
Well, a really important part of kind of preparation of news gathering stories, particularly to ensure their accuracy, is to make sure that you take care over what it is that you intend to publish. And so they often try to contact people that are directly or indirectly linked to an article that they want to publish. It's really important they're able to do so, so they give people the opportunity to comment, for example, on allegations that have been made about them, or these people may be best placed to give them correct information about a story that they're intending to run.
So regular listeners of this podcast will know that this is the time that we talk about the editor's code of practice, which is the set of rules that Ipse regulated publications have to follow. So clause 3 of the code covers harassment, and there are three parts to this clause. So part 1 says that journalists must not engage in intimidation, harassment or persistent pursuit. Clause 2 says they must not persist in questioning, telephoning, pursuing or photographing individuals once asked to desist or remain on the property when asked to leave. And if requested, they must identify themselves and who they represent. And part 3 says that editors must ensure these principles are observed by those working for them and take care not to use non-compliant material from other sources. So we'll kind of, let's break this down in the real world, Lauren. What does this mean?
So the real main focus of clause 3 and the part that is most frequently engaged is that part about them not persisting in questioning, telephoning, pursuing or photographing once asked to desist. And that term really means if you tell a journalist to go away, not to contact you again, and request, as we say, for them to desist, they should do so. And that is the main kind of crux of clause 3. A clear request for someone not to contact you again should be respected. There's also this idea that they obviously have to identify themselves and who they work for, and also that even if it's a freelancer, so someone who isn't working for a member publication per se, if they contact you and the material they get from you and is published by one of our members, they then become responsible for it.
Yes, I think that's a very good and interesting point, actually, Lauren. So all kind of photographs or information that is kind of gathered under circumstances of harassment, kind of the code would apply to that, is that correct?
Absolutely. So any of our member publications, they are responsible for the material they publish and how that was obtained. Even if it wasn't their own journalist who went and took the photograph or asked the questions, once they publish information or photographs gained that way, they are responsible for it.
And of course, the reason for that is that ultimately the kind of regulated entity, the thing that Ipse regulates, is the publisher.
Yeah, exactly.
Say, one of the reasons that we're talking about harassment today is because Ipse kind of has a number of powers around press harassment and potential press intrusion. There are quite a few things that we can do to help. Say we have, and I'm sure the Ipse staff will not mind a bit me sharing this with our podcast listeners. So we have a 24-hour, 365-day-a-year kind of harassment helpline. So that is a number that people who are worried about press intrusion can ring to talk about their kind of worries. I'm sure you know that number off by heart, Lauren. No? Oh, well, that's a disappointment. We'll have to get that in at the end. And we also have the power to send out what is called a private advisory notice. So tell us a little bit about how those work, Lauren.
Yeah, so first of all, in terms of the advice line, you're correct. Someone is always available for a member of the public who's concerned about approaches they're getting from the journalists to speak to us. And this is because we totally recognise how kind of intrusive and upsetting it can sometimes be whenever these issues happen. We can either give them practical advice if it's simply things like, you know, as I talked about, how to make a request to desist, what you should say to a journalist, through to practical advice of things they can do like changing voicemails and having automatic out of offices, notices and things they can put on their door. But there are certain circumstances where it will be appropriate for us to send out, as you've mentioned, a private advisory notice. So this is something we circulate to all our members and even some non-members who wish to comply with them. And they really communicate a request from a particular individual or group of individuals to the whole media. So that is a request such as, do not contact me again about this story. I do not want to speak about it. Or, photographers are currently outside my home. I request that they leave. And so we can put in code terms the concerns that people have and make the whole industry at once aware. We find these are usually really effective. Whilst they're not legally binding, they are simply advisory. Our members take them very seriously. And people usually say that within 5 to 10 minutes of us sending them out, they find that the conduct they're concerned about ceases.
I'm trying to think about the figures for last year. So I think last year we probably sent around 150 of these private advisory notices. And obviously, although they're confidential, I think we can talk broadly about some of the things that they might cover.
Yeah, so they cover a range of kind of instances. They can go from someone who perhaps is famous or linked to a famous individual, and there's a story at the moment in the news about them and people are desperate to get the first picture of them or get their comment. But it can also be members of the public who are caught up in kind of tragic circumstances. So a family member may have recently passed away here or abroad, for example, or there might be kind of widespread media interest in a story about yourself or a family member, and we can send them out. It can also cover kind of certain circumstances as well. So people sometimes contact us if a family member is going to have a funeral and it's, you know, for some reason high profile and they've got concerns that members of the press may try to attend, and we can send them out kind of preemptively as well in circumstances like that.
So if I were kind of worried about press intrusion and had been kind of approached by a journalist for some kind of some scandalous incident in my private life, what advice would you give to me?
So first of all, I think we always try to make clear to people it is part of journalists' jobs to contact people for comment. The fact that someone has come to you in the first instance, you know, isn't in itself a kind of breach of the code. But it's very important that people feel comfortable and able to be clear to journalists and to say, I do not want you to contact me again, and to feel that that request is going to be respected. So we can help people with some kind of advice of the wording that is best used to journalists, and also how to communicate that. So we say, you know, you yourself don't have to be the person to communicate it. It can be a family member or someone acting on your behalf and can go and speak to the journalists and make them aware. It can also take the form of, as we've talked about, perhaps putting a note on your door to say, if you're a member of the press, do not, you know, ring the doorbell. I don't want to speak to you. Things like changing your voicemail, for example, so that that makes journalists aware automatically and that you're not going to be giving them comment. So there's some practical advice that I can give to people who are getting contacts from journalists.
And of course, you can always call Ipse 24/7
absolutely,
and that press intrusion line, and we will be able to give kind of specific advice that's tailored to your circumstances. So I think probably the best way to get more of an understanding of how this clause works is to look at some IPSA rulings about harassment. And interestingly, like, this isn't one of the clauses of the code where we receive a lot of complaints, is it?
No, so it's definitely not a clause of the code where we get a lot of complaints that kind of raise that possible breach that we're looking for to investigate them. It's very rare that someone can say to us, I requested a journalist to stop contacting me, and they continued.
So the first ruling we are going to look at is Gordon versus Sunday Life. So Mr. Gordon is a kind of company owner and in Northern Ireland, and he was kind of caught up in a kind of high profile kind of media story. This is quite an interesting one, actually, because he was contacted by the media and he said that he didn't want to comment, and he had a private advisory notice kind of circulated on his behalf. And then he was, after that notice, contacted again, and he said that this was a breach of Clause 3. Was it, Lauren?
Yes. So, very interestingly, as you've touched on there, we circulated this notice for Mr. Gordon saying he did not want to speak about a high-profile eviction his company had been involved in. A couple of days later, he then got an email to his work email address from a journalist from Sunday Life. They requested his comment, though, in relation to other claims. So it wasn't about the eviction issue, but there are other claims and allegations that had been made about his business. They referenced in their email the fact that they were aware that this private advisory notice had been circulated, but they were contacting him to give him the opportunity to respond to these new allegations. They outlined the public interest they believed there was in giving him the opportunity to comment on this, and so then it was for the committee to decide whether or not this was a breach of Clause 3. In this instance, they found that it wasn't. So they made it very clear that private advisory notices aren't a blanket ban on all contact from journalists, and they also don't prohibit journalists from printing any further stories about a subject.
And I think kind of the key point here is that the kind of request for comment was related to kind of new and distinct claims, and where it was kind of in the public interest that Mr. Gordon was kind of given the opportunity to comment on those. Another thing that I thought was interesting from the ruling was that the committee kind of set out that because they kind of sent a polite email to his kind of professional business address, that this was kind of like, this was kind of a fair approach.
Yeah, so there's obviously different levels of intrusion. Receiving an email from someone to a work address that, as they say, was polite and, you know, kind of made clear claims that they wanted a response to, has a limited intrusion compared with someone turning up at your doorstep, you know, having a camera in your face, being cornered without kind of realising and being asked questions in person. So in that respect, they found that given the limited level of intrusion and the public interest, that didn't amount to a breach of Clause 3.
So if we turn to McAlpine versus the Scottish Sun, so tell us a little bit about this complaint.
So this is a complaint which took place in that traditional kind of doorstepping scenario. So Mr. McAlpine was a prison officer, and allegations had been made about his conduct and whether he would be kind of fit to be a professional anymore. And that was kind of going through an employment tribunal at the time. So the first reporter approached him at his house, kind of asked him for comment on these claims. And he said he wasn't going to talk about that. And then the reporter left. And a month later, then a second reporter came back and spoke to him. At this time, the case had moved on. He had, in fact, been dismissed. And they asked him if he wanted to comment on that. So comment on kind of the development in the story. Mr. McAlpine complained to us and said, I made it clear kind of on that first instance that I, you know, kind of wasn't going to comment on it. This should not have come back. Coming back, you know, was a failure to respect that requested assist. So this is interesting because it really gets down to that idea of the wording that is used. saying, I am not going to talk about that, the committee really took as a no comment response to someone saying no comment to those allegations. He didn't make clear, though, you know, I do not want to speak to you, leave and don't come back. Again, things had moved on whenever they made that second approach a month later, and it was legitimate for them to approach him in that way. It's worth noting that whenever he in that second approach did tell the journalist to leave, they left immediately. And in those circumstances, the committee found there's no breach of Clause 3.
It's interesting that you mentioned kind of the wording that people use when they're making a kind of desist request. And actually, kind of there isn't really a set wording as such. I mean, it's kind of not that there has to be a very specific way of wording things, but you do need to make clear that you don't want to be contacted.
Exactly. So actually another decision with the Warwickshire Police versus the Sun, that's exactly what the committee said. So they say that a request to desist can take many forms and, you know, it should be effective so long as you convey to the journalist that you do not wish to be contacted further. We don't want it to be too prescriptive. We don't want to have a certain set of words member of the public have to use or be aware of, but it just has to be very clear. That it's kind of any future contact you don't want to happen.
So in this Warwickshire Police versus the Sun ruling, so this in this case, the complainant was a victim in a criminal case where there were allegations of non-recent sex offences. So obviously a lot of care has to be taken here around kind of the news gathering and reporting process.
Yes.
And tell us what happened in this case.
Yes, so this complainant, first of all, received a phone call from a journalist. As you've alluded to there, he was kind of involved in, he was a victim of sexual assault and an ongoing court case at the time. Journalist, on behalf of the Sun, contacted him about this. He said, you know, I don't really want to say anything about this. I don't really want to give my story. And the journalist said, well, I'll call back tomorrow, I'll give you a chance to think about it. There was a discrepancy about whether he then after that said, you know, don't bother. But really, the case concerned the second phone call. So the journalist did call back the next day and again said, is it, you know, have you changed your mind? Do you want to comment on this at all? And he made clear that no, you know, I've thought about it. I don't want to comment on this. There's no point kind of contacting me again. There was then a third phone call, which was the journalist had a follow-up phone call just to be sure, you know, if you change your mind, here are my details. And the committee found that that third approach was a breach of the code. There was no justification.
They had been asked to desist from contacting that person and they continued to approach them.
Exactly, yeah. And they also, you know, realised that the circumstances about which they were contacting the complainant were extremely personal and sensitive in nature. And so even though the complainant wasn't kind of the most forthright in his request to desist, one had been made and the journalist should have requested that, should have respected that.
Yeah. And again, another point of interest from this ruling is obviously where a complaint is being upheld, as this one has under clause three, then we have to look at what kind of remedial action is required for redress. And here, there was no kind of published article as such where we could kind of put a correction or an adjudication. So what did the newspaper, I think, was the Sun, have to do in this case?
Yes, so that's correct. No story was actually published kind of off the back of this. It was just simply about the conduct that was complained about, and the committee decided that an adjudication was the correct kind of form of kind of remedial action.
Serious kind of breach
exactly.
of the code.
Exactly, yeah, serious breach of the code that couldn't be remedied by a kind of simple correction. What the newspaper needed to do was explain to its readers kind of what action it had taken, why that wasn't acceptable, and what the regulator had found in those circumstances.
And that adjudication was published on page 2 of the newspaper.
Yeah.
And it also, in terms of the website, they had to publish a link of the full adjudication appearing in the top 50% of stories.
Yeah.
An interesting one there where there wasn't actually a story, but an adjudication was still required. And finally, we've brought to discuss today also Arcadia Group versus the Telegraph. And this again is an interesting one, kind of about who can be harassed. Yeah. I think lots of listeners will remember that there are a number of high profile stories. So this is the kind of the group owned by Sir Philip Greenway, it's kind of Topshop mm-hmm. and Burton and all of those kind of things. And there was a sort of scandal around that company, and they made a complaint saying that the company had been harassed. Do you want to explain a bit more about this?
Exactly. So the context of the complaint was that they believed Arcadia Group, as a kind of commercial entity, was being harassed because journalists working for the Daily Telegraph had made a number of approaches to former and current employees of the group, trying to get comment from them about ongoing kind of employment related issues. So it's definitely worth making very clear that they were not acting on behalf of these individuals who had had approaches. They didn't have their consent to do so. So the complaint very much was, in approaching these people, we as a corporate entity are being harassed. Which is a very interesting kind of novel concept for the committee to consider.
And of course, you know, where journalists are kind of quite rightly doing that news gathering on a, you know, it was a very kind of high profile story in the public interest about kind of sexual harassment allegations, where quite rightly journalists kind of will want to find out more about what's happening. So that was kind of part of the balance of consideration as well, wasn't it?
Exactly. So whenever you look at the committee's ruling, in fact, they say and totally recognise the kind of public interest in journalists making approaches to what they call third parties, so people that they believe and may be able to provide further information about a particular story. As we've touched on, you know, Clause 3 certainly doesn't seek to prevent that. It doesn't seek to prevent journalists from making those approaches, but instead it's there to protect individuals.
Mm-hmm. So you had an individual who had been approached, made a complaint on their own behalf, perhaps circumstances might have been different in a kind of sort of fantasy.
Yeah, work. Of course. I mean, we obviously don't know the details of any kind of conduct, but an individual would have had the standing to make their own complaint and for it to be assessed on its own merits. But in this instance, the committee said that Clause 3 is actually trying to prevent very specific harm to individuals. It's about, you know, the distressing, possibly upsetting nature of these approaches. And that isn't something that can be experienced by a corporate entity. So that kind of intrusive experience that we're trying to prevent cannot be experienced by the corporate entity that was complaining. So Clause 3 wasn't even engaged in those circumstances.
That's very interesting, Lauren, and thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today to talk about that. So all of this information is available on our website. That's ipso.co.uk. If you have any questions, you can get in touch with us. We're on Twitter at Ipso News, or you can email us at inquiries@ipso.co.uk. And Lauren, that press intrusion helpline number that you can remember is 07799 903 99. So thanks for joining us, and we will see you again next time.